Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie. This is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes. Rate and review us there. Let us know how we're doing and what we should be doing more of and what we should be doing less of. Today, we're talking with Dan Griswold. He's at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and he studies trade, one of the most heated conversation topics on in the campaign of 2016. And it's going to be a flashpoint going forward through 4 years of Donald Trump. Dan, thanks for talking to us.
Nick, glad to be with you.
So let's talk a little bit about, the election of 2016, Bernie Sanders hammered American trade deals. Donald Trump hammered American trade deals and American trade reality, saying we were being cheated. At one point, he even said we were being raped by China and other countries, which is insane on a number of different levels and deeply disturbing. Hillary Clinton joined in. She at times was talking about NAFTA being problematic, as well as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What is Trump's basic approach to trade? And, what has you concerned about it?
Well, he says he's for free trade, and then he proceeds to say all sorts of crazy things that would take us back, if it was fully implemented, take us back really to the 1930s, in the Smoot-Hawley days. He's come out against virtually every trade agreement we've signed. He's questioned the World Trade Organization. He's called the North American Free Trade Agreement a disaster. As you mentioned, he's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership the rape of America. This is very extreme rhetoric. It's the most protectionist rhetoric we've heard from a major party candidate on trade. You have to go back maybe a century. So it's very, very disturbing.
So can I ask,
very counter to what Republicans have been saying in recent years as well.
Although it was interesting that in the last Republican presidential debate, which I believe among the last four guys standing were John Kasich, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and Trump. And I remember being struck by this, that at one point they all said that they were for fair trade, not for free trade. And that, of course, fair trade is a buzzword that was normally associated with people from the Democratic Party. And certainly that's what Bernie Sanders talked about. What is going on with the Republican Party? Because at least, obviously Herbert Hoover had his problems. But in recent memory, and certainly people like George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan were super free traders. They were, and even Bill Clinton, the Democrat who beat George H.W. Bush in 92, finished up the NAFTA agreements, the North American Free Trade Association agreement or agreement. So, what happened to the Republicans that they nominated a guy and they seem to be in lockstep somewhat talking about fair trade rather than free trade?
Yeah, Nick, and both parties have their populist wings, right? You mentioned Bernie Sanders, and they're actually, it's a majority view, I think, within the Democratic Party to question trade deals, and certainly within the Democratic caucus. The Republicans have tended to be more in favor of trade, right? And you get a majority of Republican members in Congress voting for trade agreements. Recent Republican presidents have been supportive. So, yeah, something's going on. I think in this case, there's so much for lots of different reasons. There's so much anxiety out there among the public. And Trump was just able to whip that up, making trade a focus of discontent, even though I think you and I know that trade isn't what's driving the economic frustrations out there. So he was able to exploit that.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because it's also true that Hillary Clinton, I mean, she was kind of she was in a position that was kind of analogous to Mitt Romney arguing against Obamacare, where during as Secretary of State, she had supported and promoted the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a planned agreement that would have about a dozen countries, including the United States, all in a free trade agreement. And the specific goal of that is to actually kind of quarantine China or to create a countervailing power, which in at least one of the debates, Trump didn't seem to understand. He seemed to equate Chinese trade with the TPP. I think it was Rand Paul who corrected him on that. But so even Barack Obama is, relatively in favor of free trade, or the big, the current free trade deal that's on the on the board. So do two things. One, do a quick lesson for us in why free trade is generally beneficial, and then talk a little bit about how the TPP seems to be suffering from this larger economic slowdown that you've mentioned.
Well, Nick, the argument for free trade starts with the individual, the freedom of you and I to spend our hard-earned dollars the way we want, to buy the products that are most attractive to us in terms of their quality and variety and price. And we can get the best bargains if we can shop in the global marketplace, right? Tariffs are really taxes on consumers for choosing foreign-made goods. They reduce competition. They lead to domestic oligopolies that can exploit consumers. So if you think the free market is good, free trade flows from that. And we've known that since Adam Smith and Frederick Bastiat.
But let me just to step in to put a little more, at least for listeners of a certain age, they'll, I think, understand this. So this means after World War II. For instance, when the Detroit auto manufacturers, Chrysler, Ford, and GM, were able to say, okay, we're not really going to let that many cars be imported from foreign countries, from Europe or Asia. And it meant that we, you know, that American auto manufacturers had a virtual lock on the marketplace. It also means that we paid more for cars. But does it also, on the flip side, and this is what the populists say, but it also allowed for those auto manufacturers to pay really high wages, which so we help out everybody by making everybody pay more for everything, and then we all become richer.
Yeah, the auto sector is a good example, Nick, and I won't speak for you, but I can remember the 1970s and what cars were like in the 1970s. You know, poor gas mileage. They weren't as safe. They didn't look as good. Today's cars are so much better.
We would have parties, literally parties in the street, if a car turned over 100,000 miles on the odometer and reset. And now you don't even replace the spark plugs until 100,000 miles. So.
Right. Cars are so much better, and it's largely to do with foreign competition. Mm-hmm. And the cars made domestically are so much better. And here's where you get to jobs. We don't have as many jobs in the automotive sector the way we don't have as many jobs in the manufacturing sector as we did, say, in 1979. That's actually when good old 1979, when manufacturing employment peaked.
And
I remember
that,
1979. Yeah. It wasn't such a great time for the U.S. economy.
Well, and it's fascinating because that was when the employment in manufacturing peaked in absolute numbers as a percentage of the economy. Manufacturing peaked in 1943. So
yes.
It's even more amazing that people like Trump and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are saying, oh, we got to bring back manufacturing jobs. And, you know, it was only a plurality of the workforce during World War II. The nostalgia here, and I agree, I do remember 1979, also the year that about the highest percentage of high school seniors were smoking pot on a regular basis. And I suspect driving a Chevy Vega and being in double-digit inflation and double-digit unemployment probably led to the pot smoking as well.
Yeah, there was a lot going on then. But the point is, manufacturing employment is on a long downward trend. And, Nick, that's true of every advanced economy in the world. We have a thriving manufacturing sector today, including a thriving automobile sector. Mm-hmm. They're producing, we're exporting a record number of cars, 2 million last year. They're better cars. But the thing is, they're being made by fewer workers because they're so much more productive.
Right.
It's automation. Automation has eliminated far more manufacturing jobs than trade. If you want to bring back manufacturing jobs, tariffs aren't going to do it. You've got to outlaw machines and robots. And we wouldn't want to do that because we'd be poor. And the manufacturing jobs that employed a lot of people were not jobs our future is going to be based on, right? They were making shoes and shirts and
farming,
textiles,
planting
furniture.
Seeds, things like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
here, and you know, specifically about China, I mean, one of the things, and I highly recommend people read your Mad About Trade blog, which is a wealth of information. I mean, you've pointed out Donald Trump demagogued China. He said, you know, China is a currency yes. manipulator. It's the biggest currency manipulator in the world. In fact, the United States government's official verdicts on this don't actually show that. And you've yes. also pointed out that since 1997, around the time that China entered the World Trade Organization, the general tariffs on a lot of goods that come into the U.S., or rather that the U.S. was sending there, have been reduced from 25% to something like 7%. So yes. China, it's actually China charges us less to sell stuff there than ever before. Is that correct? I mean, we have more access to Chinese markets than we did 20 years ago.
That is correct. And over the last 15 years, our exports to China have actually been growing at a faster rate than imports from China. But Nick, let's just step back and appreciate what we get from our trade relationship with China. First, we get a lot of wonderful, useful consumer goods that make our lives better every day, right? Shoes, consumer electronics. And that's especially important for low-income Americans who spend a higher proportion of their budget on these kind of staple items. We also benefit being able to sell into China. It's now the world's number one automotive market, and 1.3 billion consumers and a huge growing middle class. They're our number three export market. But finally, we benefit.
Can I ask, by the way, what's number one and two?
Canada and Mexico.
Yeah, and so, here's another question, and this I'm asking you because this is where I got the information, but how much, what are the big tariffs? NAFTA is supposedly, Donald Trump has called it the worst trade deal ever. What are the tariffs that Americans spend, or, you know, that American manufacturers and good providers, when we're exporting to China, or rather to Mexico and Canada, what do we have to pay at the border?
Well, zero because of NAFTA. You know, how do you talk about fair trade? How do you improve on an agreement that has zero tariffs either way? This is the level playing field the politicians have told us they've wanted. And NAFTA it's delivered on its central promise of more trade, right? We have more than $1 trillion of goods in crossing borders in North America. It has given us an integrated automobile and other manufacturing sectors, allowing them to be more competitive in global markets. And Nick, the thing that we don't appreciate about NAFTA is how it's helped to transform Mexico. It has institutionalized their economic reforms. They're a lively, pluralistic democracy. They have a growing middle class. They're a better neighbor because of NAFTA. You know, I suppose the one encouraging thing, Trump has called NAFTA a disaster. 4 years ago, he called the Electoral College a disaster, but he's changed his mind on that right. in recent weeks. Maybe he'll change his mind on NAFTA.
Well, and especially because, you know, he obviously, along with hating on trade, he also has, you know, said just vile things about Mexicans. But he also yes. seems to misunderstand that Mexicans, there's a net outflow of Mexicans, legal and otherwise, from the United States because the Mexican economy, relatively speaking, is doing better than it was 10 years ago. So maybe he'll wake up. And that's you would argue that's due in large part, or at least in significant part, to NAFTA, which has helped Mexico become a richer, better country than it would be otherwise.
Yeah, it's taken some time. Mexico has some problems, as you know, with unionization and other things. And demographics, of course, are at play here. But yes, if we make it harder for Mexicans to make stuff and sell them in the United States, they'll export their labor. They'll have another incentive to come here. And by the way, of the stuff we import from Mexico, the content is 40% American. So if we start raising tariffs on stuff coming in from Mexico, we're actually going to be penalizing our own producers who are selling into Mexico as part of integrated supply chains.
And by that, you mean to keep it with cars. I mean, it's, you know, a General Motors car, some of it is made here. It might end up in Mexico for a little bit to get more work done. Then it comes back here.
Right.
I mean, that and the same is true of Canada as well, that we are able to, you know, move to where the labor is best or the pricing is best and things like that with a freedom that was unimaginable when we were in the 70s.
Exactly. So we basically have an integrated North American market, which has been good for Canada, the United States, and Mexico. We're more competitive abroad. And, you know, Nick, one of the ironies of President-elect Trump's trade policy, he fancies himself a successful businessman. But here you've got Canada, Mexico, and China are the top three customers U.S. exports. What are the three countries that we're going to pick a trade fight with right out of the box? Canada, Mexico, and China. What business model do you go about antagonizing your top three?
Well, part of it is that you can almost hear him say, well, you know, like I'm just negotiating. This is a negotiation. And, you know, what as president, what kind of power does the president have to unilaterally dictate trade policy? I mean, I think we can all be worried about his rhetoric. And again, I say this as somebody who is all of my grandparents were immigrants. So whenever anybody starts and they came from shitty countries, they came from Italy and Ireland, you know, the slums and the refuse dumps of southern and Western Europe. I always get worried about that.
I won't hold it against you, Nick.
Well, you know, this is what is great about America, right, is that you can come here and be hated for who you are, not who your parents were. But can the president, you know, unilaterally, how much can they screw up trade?
This is a scary thing. They can do a lot. You know, constitutionally, it's up to Congress to determine tariffs. The last time Congress rolled up its sleeves and wrote a tariff bill was the Smoot-Hawley tariff bill in 1930. That didn't work out so well.
Yeah, and I mean, the Smoot-Hawley used to be, before we became fabulously wealthy, relatively speaking, after World War II, that was a shorthand for the dumbest kind of economic moves a government could make. Recap that or reprise that for our younger listeners who have no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah, America was a protectionist country through the 1920s, and we grew wealthy despite that protectionism, not because of it. And in one last effort to save jobs and promote, it started trying to protect farmers, and then it spread to protecting industry. The U.S. raised its tariffs significantly in 1930, thinking it would preserve jobs. What happened, Nick, and this is a good lesson for today, other countries responded. They raised their tariff barriers in response to us raising ours. Our exports plunged, our imports plunged, global trade went in a downward spiral that lengthened and prolonged the Great Depression. Mm. And here's another lesson. It aggravated tensions worldwide. The Germans couldn't repay their World War I debts because they couldn't earn money selling into our markets. That just deepened their grievances, and it contributed to World War II. And out of World War II, we came to a bipartisan consensus in this country to turn away from inward-looking protectionism, to engage and lead in the global economy. And that meant the president and the Congress working together to sign trade agreements with other countries, the GATT, and then the World Trade Organization, these bilateral and regional agreements we've signed since then, including NAFTA. And you have to say it's given us a more open, prosperous economy. It has helped to lift about 1 billion people out of poverty in the last 25 years around the world. Right. And Nick, it's given us a more peaceful world, hasn't it? Countries that trade with each other are less likely to go to war. The immediate goal after the war was to make sure the Western powers didn't fight a third destructive world war in the 20th century. You have to say it was pretty successful in that respect. So this 70-year bipartisan policy of expanding trade through agreements to not only promote prosperity, but to promote world peace, it seems to be, at the very least, has come to a screeching halt with President-elect Trump and the prospects of it. Our biggest job right now is to make sure we don't slide backwards, because that would be a disaster. That would be a true disaster all around.
Do you worry about, you know, we do have a Republican Congress, you know, a majority in the Senate and in the House. People like Jeff Sessions, who's been tapped to be Trump's attorney general and was the architect in many ways of Trump's anti-immigration policy, is also very much anti-free trade. He tends to be very protectionist. Yes. There are protectionists within the Republican Party, and there are certainly protectionists within the Democratic Party, and then independents like Bernie Sanders. You know, what can you, if you take the temperature of Congress right now, are they pro or against Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is coming up towards, you know, a culmination? And again, this is a multilateral, multinational deal that was started under Bush and was going to be completed under Obama. Are we in a new phase of, you know, where Congress is going to be like, well, hey, we're not touching TPP with a 10-foot pole?
Yeah, Nick, I think in the short run, TPP is, if not dead, it's comatose, or as USTR Mike Froman said, it's in purgatory. Mm-hmm. It could be revived in some form or the other. But at the very least, we've lost an opportunity to get trade barriers down. It would have eliminated 18,000 tariffs against U.S. exports. It would have given us free trade in things like data flows, and governments wouldn't be allowed to require that servers be localized, so the cloud would be international rather than controlled by government. So that's a short-term loss. You asked about the mood in Congress. I do think the Republican leadership remains committed to pursuing trade liberalization. And I'm thinking of Paul Ryan, the Ways and Means Chairman. Kevin Brady is particularly committed to free trade. I think Mitch McConnell is as well. You have certain constitutional checks. The president does have a lot of power to at least temporarily disrupt trade. Trump can withdraw us from these various agreements. I have to think, you know, Nick, there is something of a tradition of presidents sounding more protectionist on the campaign trail, like Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. Remember, he was going to renegotiate NAFTA or withdraw. Once he became president, he thought better of that. And then he's actually given us, he's signed free trade agreements, given us free trade. Mm-hmm. I think with Donald Trump, I'm cautiously pessimistic about trade under President Trump. I think he's going to run into certain realities. I think he's going to have enough economic advisors around him who understand economics are going to say, look, all the things you want to do in creating jobs and lifting the working class in America are going to be harmed, not helped, by picking trade wars with China and other major trading partners. So at the very least, I think this trade expansion has come to a halt. The real test, Nick, and I think you and I and our libertarian friends, our free market friends, are going to have to fight a good battle on this to remind people of what's at stake. Protectionism is a failed policy. We need to move ahead, not backwards.
Talk a little bit about libertarians have a kind of strained relationship with things like NAFTA or Trans-Pacific Partnership. Before you were at Mercatus, you were at CATA for a long time. I've been a Reason my entire professional life. And you hear this all the time from libertarians. I believe in free trade, but TPP, NAFTA, CAFTA, these are managed trade. They're thousands of pages long. They're not real free trade. I can remember back when the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which was kind of an appendix to NAFTA, was signed on, and it included, reducing tariffs with such economic powerhouses as the Dominican Republic. Ron Paul, you know, a great libertarian politician, was against it, as if the kind of zombie baseball stitchers of the Dominican Republic were a threat to American jobs.
Yes.
How do you answer libertarian, specifically libertarian critiques of these trade deals as managed trade and as of, you know, just, you know, fever swamps of protected interests?
Yeah. Well, first, I would agree with them to the extent that the best trade policy is just to get rid of our trade barriers for our own sake and let other countries do the same based on what's best for them. For various reasons, that's hard to do in the United States. And the last time Congress just tried to unilaterally do trade policy, we got what we were talking about in the 1930s. This is a messy, imperfect world. And these trade agreements, if I were writing these trade agreements, they'd be a lot shorter. But let me give you, there's two advantages in engaging in these agreements. One, we get our barriers down and we get other countries' barriers down. So trade is freer in two ways. And secondly, we get it in writing so that when we come on to an economic distress like the Great Recession of 2008-2009, governments can better resist the call of raising trade barriers to protect jobs, however mistaken that is. I think to call these agreements managed trade is not not fair. They reduce trade barriers. They're as long as they are because they have to do with phase-in periods and rules of origin and other complicated things like that. But the results of the World Trade Organization, of NAFTA, of CAFTA, has been you and I are freer as consumers to spend our money in the global marketplace. We're freer as producers in terms of our companies to engage in global commerce, to engage in global supply chains. These trade agreements have left us freer, and I think libertarians should support that.
Talk a little to the, you know, assume you're talking to somebody who is, you know, has had stagnant or falling wages in the United States over the past 20 years, or let's say, yes, you know, since Bill Clinton, since Al Gore in famous footage that's available on YouTube when Al Gore debated Ross Perot on the Larry King, yes, live show about Ross Perot had talked about how NAFTA would create a giant sucking sound of jobs being pulled down into Mexico. And yes, Al Gore, to his undying credit, kicked Perot's ass with facts and logic and just argumentation. What about, you know, what is holding back people who have seen, you know, bad job prospects for the past couple of decades? And how do you reach them with the message that it's not about trade? It's, you know, that's something else.
Yeah. Well, first, it isn't about trade for the vast majority of workers. Yes, trade does displace some workers. But, you know, Nick, we live in a dynamic market economy where there are literally millions of jobs disappearing each month and being created each month. The best estimates are trade's responsible for about 3% of that job displacement. The biggest displacer of employment is technology. you know, Uber coming in and taxi drivers,
right,
losing their job, or robots,
travel agents, right? I mean, agents, they're still around and they do good work, but you don't need them the way that you did pre-Travelocity.
I used to make my living in the daily newspaper business. Half of newspaper newsroom jobs have disappeared over the last 20 years. It's not because of trade. It's because of technology. And here's the thing. If we want to equip ourselves for the jobs of today and tomorrow, the answer is not to raise tariffs and bring back certain jobs of yesterday that weren't all that great. It's to better equip ourselves. So here you get into purely domestic issues like improving our K-12 education system. It is scandalous that an advanced country like the United States has such a mediocre primary and secondary education system that's turning out graduates who are not equipped for the jobs of today and tomorrow. And Nick, you don't have to have a master's degree in computer engineering, but how about an associate's degree in some kind of employable job like healthcare and things like that. So education, job retraining, better labor mobility so that people can move around. And how about making health insurance and retirement savings portable from one job to another? So leaving a job doesn't mean you lose those things. So we need to help prepare people for the jobs of today and tomorrow, not try to interfere in trade and other aspects of the market, you know, restoring some nostalgic past that we can't.
What about, and we'll end on a potentially a cautiously, you were talking about being a cautious pessimist about Trump and trade. Are you cautiously optimistic about Trump and regulation? He has made a lot of talk about getting rid of certain types of regulations that are muffling economic activity. Is that a place where Trump may be onto something positive rather than negative?
Yes, Nick, and this is a good note to end on. You know, my program here at Mercatus, where we talk about trade and immigration, is one of eight programs here. And I'd have to say most of my colleagues here at the Mercatus Center are cautiously optimistic, regulation being one area, corporate taxation, healthcare, and these sorts of things. You know, Nick, I think the biggest problem facing working class America is our slow growth rate, right? 1.5% growth. While it's creating enough jobs to keep up with the growth in the labor force, it's not leading to higher real wages. If we could somehow ramp up our growth rate to 3%, I think that would address a lot of these issues. And you do that through deregulation, You do that through sensible tax reform. You do that through help stimulate the economy through sensible infrastructure investments, not spending money for the sake of spending money, but helping to make our economy overall more productive. So you do those things. And again, the theme is these are things we need to do here at home. The temptation is to point abroad at some foreign bogeyman, right? China, Mexico, immigrants. No, they're not the problem. They're actually a blessing to the United States to be engaged. But we need to get our house in order here at home. And that's more difficult for the politicians to grapple with because the responsibility really comes down to them to govern more responsibly here in the United States.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you, Dan Griswold.
Nick, it's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with Dan Griswold. Check him out at madabouttrade.com. It's a great blog about everything related to trade and trade-related issues. He's a senior research fellow and co-director on the American Economy and Globalization Project at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. This has been the Reason Podcast, and I'm Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us there as well.